Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In Norfolk, Virginia, the sea is getting a little too close for comfort. The water is rising, and Norfolk, like many cities, is settling lower. At high tide, the sea can now be in your lap. It doesn't take a big storm anymore to put standing water in Norfolk. In the next century, scientists say, cities all over the world are going to be confronting what Norfolk is confronting now. They're talking climate change this week in Cancun, but Norfolk is already way into the fight. This hour on Point, learning from Norfolk. One city battles a rising tide. You can join the conversation. Do you know what climate change may mean for your city or town? Are you ready? Are you planning? And Norfolk listeners, tell us what you're seeing already. Are you the canary in the coal mine? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio, and let us know your city and state when you comment online. Joining me first today from Norfolk, Virginia, is Teresa Whibley. She's a city councilor for Norfolk, representing Ward 2 there, which contains the Larchmont neighborhood and other areas particularly hard hit by flooding. Teresa Whibley, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you with us.
Hello. Nice to be with you.
And from Montclair, New Jersey, is Leslie Kaufman. She's a national environmental reporter for the New York Times. She's been reporting on Norfolk. Leslie Kaufman, thank you for joining us.
Hello, Tom.
It's great to have you both with us. So, Councillor Whibley, we're already getting all kinds of communications from down your way. Here's Amy Loretta says, it's terrible in Norfolk. One mid-to-heavy rainstorm and everything shuts down, streets, schools, businesses. What are you seeing, Teresa?
I'm seeing effects that are getting worse and worse. I've been in Norfolk about 30 years, and we don't even need a rainstorm. All we need is a full moon. And we can have tidal flooding pretty rampant throughout the city.
And that means challenges to the city government, the city infrastructure. Your mayor there, Paul Frame, reading here, we've been looking at the local press reporting. This is in the Virginian Pilot back in August, saying it's a daunting task, but we have to try to come to terms with it. What does it mean for the city, Teresa, to have the city settling, the seas inching up, and Norfolk facing that water?
Well, as you said, it's an interruption in our day. When roads are closed, when people can't leave their homes, when people's cars are flooded out, if there's a rainstorm that catches them unaware, it really is a part of our life. And when other people get weather reports, we get flooding reports.
They're talking about turning to the federal government for flood mitigation money, but I'm reading here Vice Mayor Anthony Burfoot saying, that asking for that, you know, what's coming here along the coast may overwhelm the federal government.
You know, Norfolk isn't going to be able to handle this on its own. We're an urban city that has the same financial struggles that most cities have at this day and age. This is going to be a huge issue for not just Norfolk, but all of our East Coast. And I'd like to see that we get started on this discussion. We start involving not only the federal and state levels, but also some of our private concerns, because this is also impacting so many of our industries that are along the water also, and the Navy.
Industries and the Navy, very, very big naval facilities here at the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, of course, just south of Washington, D.C. Leslie, I mean, everybody's talking about it down there. We'll have the Rear Admiral of the Navy, David Titley, will be in just across the way in Hampton Roads tomorrow at Old Dominion University. He's the Navy's chief oceanographer, saying he's making big plans here. I'm looking at his quote here from Old Dominion press office. They're saying, this is the Admiral, saying they've given me, that is the Navy, marching orders to take a hard look at this. And the more you look at the data, the Admiral says, the more you realize we have to do some very different things in the 21st century. We certainly see this, he says, as a national security issue. And I'm reading here as well, Leslie, the president of Old Dominion is unveiling tomorrow a big initiative down there. This is just across the water from Norfolk, to become a national hub for research, teaching, and expertise in rising sea levels related to climate change. The Old Dominion president, John Broderick, says, we're forced to take very seriously the scientific evidence that predicts the ocean's rise of 2 feet or more by the end of the century. Of course, others are saying three, others are saying more. He says, it's as if we live in a climate science fishbowl here on the Virginia coast. What about this spot on the coast, Leslie, and how it compares to others around the country?
Right. The reason we did our article, I did an article about climate change down in Norfolk, is Norfolk is leading the way. If you look at charts of who's sinking, Norfolk is having its sea level rise, its relative sea level rise has been faster than any other place on the East Coast. This is a combination of both their land sinking and water rising. It's about half of each.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, they tell us a little bit about what our future looks like all across the East Coast. That's why we're at Norfolk. That's why we're looking at how they're coping and the decisions they're going to have to make. And it should also, as you're pointing out here, it should be prompting the government to think about big decisions that are going to have to be made all up and down the East Coast, because there is not enough money for everyone to get a seawall. There may not even be enough engineering to build seawalls for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So some big decisions are ahead.
Not just in Norfolk, but all around the country, around the world. I'm looking at here some other reporting from your paper, talking with scientists, saying there's more or less a consensus emerging around maybe a 3-foot sea rise globally. Could be less, they say, but it could be much more. Would cause faster erosion of beaches, barrier islands, marshes, would contaminate fresh water supplies with salt. And looking at that East Coast and, of course, the Gulf Coast, where New Orleans is the lowest and Corpus Christi is quite low as well, hard hit in New York. Again, looking at the reporting here, coastal flooding could be routine. Large parts of Queens and Brooklyn, especially vulnerable. 15% of the urbanized land in the Miami region could be inundated. And here in this reporting, saying the ocean could encroach more than a mile inland in parts of North Carolina. That will get your attention. Leslie, you were talking with Hazel Peck, who I think lives in Teresa Whibley's ward down there. What's her experience? Make it real for us. What's her experience, daily experience of it, or frequent?
Well, and Teresa can tell you about her constituents, but I went and talked to Hazel, who's been living in that neighborhood for 40 years, and now when they know they're going to have a high tide, so you know how most commuters check traffic every day? They're watching the lunar calendar, because if they know they're going to have a full moon, they know they will not be able to pull out of their driveways in the morning.
And that's because the full moon is going to pull in that higher tide, and the sea's just at the relative high point already to bring it right in onto the street?
That's right. So they routinely get, not every full moon, because there are different cycles of the moon in terms of strength and closeness, but especially in the fall, the full moons and the spring, the full moons, they tell me, will bring 2 to 3 foot puddles on their street. Now, as I wrote in my story, they are doing a construction project on that street to try and mitigate some of that problems, but it's going to cost over $1 million for one street to raise 18 inches and readjust storm drains. Do that math across the East Coast, and you've got a lot of money.
Teresa, what's it like? I mean, this is your ward. It's particularly vulnerable. Never mind turning to the rest of the country. Just when you turn to the rest of your city councilors, you know, what becomes clear here is that even within one city, there can be a lot of tension about where the money is invested to save a particular neighborhood. The mayor's talking about designating some areas of your city as retreat zones where no amount of money or work will beat back the water.
That's correct. And even in Ms. Peck's neighborhood, where we've spent over $1 million raising the water, many people feel that's throwing money at a project that probably is not going to be a long-term solution. So we've really got to look not just at the short-term solutions, but the long-term. And some of those long-term solutions may be it would be better to buy properties and delegate them to not be inhabited, so that we really, as our mayor said, would be in a retreat. It's tough when you're talking to individuals. Ms. Peck's neighborhood is one of maybe 15 just in my ward that has regular flooding. And, of course, everybody is not only worried about their life and how it impacts their daily excursions, but also, frankly, their property values.
Of course. I mean, once you can't insure it, it becomes hard to sell it, I guess.
Well, and not even the insuring, just the fact that people don't want to live in a neighborhood where half of the time they have to park their car elsewhere. I have one block in my neighborhood fairly close to Ms. Peck's that last year at the beginning of the year, the first 90 days, 45 of them, the streets were flooded.
Wow. Wow. And you, Norfolk has hired a Dutch firm. They know a lot about dikes and holding water back, I guess, to look
at. We hope it'll be more than just putting your finger in the dike.
Yeah, we hope so. I mean, well, you're looking at options like inflatable dams and storm surge floodgates at the entrances to waterways, but you've got water on three sides. Do you feel like the canary in the coal mine down there, Teresa?
Yeah, we do. And but if that's what it takes to get this discussion going, you know, we, of course, are more stressed because we have we're not built on granite as New York mm-hmm. City is, or coral like Miami.
Mm-hmm.
So not only do we have the impact of that rising water, but we have the impact of our land sinking. And, you know, we are a very old city that was built back in the late 1700s, and there was landfill done then, and we're seeing the consequences of both of those impacts.
A 1-2 punch there, sinking and higher seas. Of course, that may put you out front in learning what cities all over this country, all around it, are going to need to learn. That's what Old Dominion is saying, you know, wants to make Norfolk and Hampton Roads a center in sort of getting out on this frontier. Does that look promising to you, Teresa? Is it worth it?
It's clearly worth it. We have several groups that are working together in partnership to combat and look at the best ways that we can deal with this. Old Dominion is actually a Norfolk University,
mm-hmm.
and we have a strong oceanography department, so it's the perfect center for us. And as you said, they're going to announce that program today.
City Councilor Teresa Whibley of Norfolk, we're very grateful to you for being with us. Thanks a lot for your time today.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about climate change, rising seas, and one city's battle with the high tide. We're looking at the case of Norfolk, Virginia, as in Cancun in Mexico. There's a big climate conference underway. Of course, big failure to come to a global agreement last year in Copenhagen. Now they're trying to inch forward in Cancun. Meanwhile, climate change, the scientific consensus tells us, goes forward apace. And Norfolk, between land settling and seas rising, is at the very front line of what's going on there. It may affect a lot of other American cities around the world as well before long. Leslie Kaufman is with us from the New York Times. She's been looking at the Norfolk situation. And right now we're joined as well from Norfolk, Virginia, by Skip Stiles, William Stiles. He's executive director of Wetlands Watch. It's a Norfolk-based environmental group. Skip Stiles, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
So what are you seeing in your city?
Well, it is, as Dr. Whibley described it, and it's not just here. It's all throughout eastern Virginia. We work across the Chesapeake Bay region, and we see evidence in a lot of low-lying communities of storm surges coming higher onto the land and causing increasing disruption and economic consequence. So we work mostly at the local level trying to get local governments to move on it, and we're starting to see some activity.
What about the economic consequences here? Does it have the attention of, you know, town fathers, chamber of commerce, industry there? It's clearly got the attention of the Navy. I'm reading here again Rear Admiral David Titley, who will be around town, I guess, tomorrow, saying, and he's in charge of he's chief oceanographer for the U.S. Navy, saying, I can't speak for local or state governments, but I can say for the Navy, and they have a huge presence, of course, in your neck of the woods, that when we do deliberate planning in a non-crisis environment, we have better information, we make better decisions than if we get caught by surprise or ignore a challenge until it becomes a crisis. Is Norfolk focused on what's happening, economically, Skip?
Yeah, about 60% of our regional economic activity is indirectly or directly related to the military, and much of the rest is water-dependent. Activities like shipbuilding, ship repair. We have one of the largest shipyards in the country here that builds aircraft carriers. It has gotten the attention of everybody who tries to do business along the shoreline, and the Navy has put some serious markers down. They're redecking the all 14 piers at the naval station at the cost of $60 to $70 to $80 million a pier. So there is a significant conversation going on amongst those who make money on the shoreline.
Can you explain to us the sort of combination here of settling and rising seas? What's going on there?
Well, everybody's getting sea level rise from warming oceans expanding and warming air melting glaciers. What we have here is this section of the United States is on a plate that's falling. When the glaciers were 2 miles thick over New York, we sort of went up in the air, and 20,000 years ago when the glaciers melted, we started falling. We've also got a lot of groundwater withdrawal. Our groundwater table is about 40 feet below what it was in pre-development times, so that causes the land to sink. And then you've got a lot of localized subsidence where people filled in wetlands and creeks in years past and built on it, and now it's those places are sinking. And sometimes it's block by block or parcel by parcel. One house will be on fast land and there's no problem, and the next house will be on wetlands, old filled wetlands, and it'll be sinking.
And roughly, what's the ratio for the higher water you're seeing of settling versus rising seas? How much is attributable to each?
Well, we don't have good maps in Virginia, but the smart people who study this have said that we've had about 6-7 inches of subsidence of that foot and a half, roughly. So, as Leslie said, it's getting to be about half and half. Half of its base sea level rise, and half of it's the land falling. But in some areas in Norfolk and all around the bay, you can have a whole lot more. The tide gauges out the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel are showing a much higher rate of sea level rise because there's more subsidence out there.
And give us a sense of the problems this creates and the costs that come with it. We heard Leslie and Teresa talking about raising roadways 18 inches in areas that are covered too often by water now at maybe $1 million plus per block. So there's roadways to be raised. I don't know, what about drainage? What about sewerage? What about water? What are the problems that come with this?
Well, you've got to reset all your stormwater lines because when the mouth of the stormwater pipe gets covered up, it brings water back into the neighborhoods. We have an extensive system of tunnels down here. The mouths of the tunnels were set decades ago, and so those are a problem. We have a lot of bridges that need to be reset. I mean, it gets to be an extremely large and expensive problem once you start looking at it. But I think, as Dr. Whibley said, you know, you got to just start working on it piece by piece, and we need a strategy to try to figure out where we armor and where we retreat.
How close is the city to that now? You are not going to be alone in this. I mean, the estimates are that, you know, around the world, London and Cairo, Bangkok, Venice, Shanghai may be critically endangered by sea rise in this century. How far along do you think Norfolk is in really getting its arms around what it's going to take to get on top of this, Skip?
We're really sort of at the front end right now. As I said, we need some very precise elevation data to make the decisions sort of bridge by bridge. We have a lot to learn from places like London. There's an extensive study going on there along the Thames, places in Europe that are already facing this. So there's a lot of information that we can share. Right now, I think what's involved is basically the region. You know, it's sort of like we're sitting on the examining table and the doctor just came in with an X-ray that's got a spot on it. And you go, okay, you know, you go through the five stages and then you got to do something. And we're sort of right there now. We've got to get the region together and start working on this. And, you know, on the other side of it, you can actually see a lot of economic benefit, if you will. I mean, if we're the first ones to figure this out along the East Coast, we can sell it to the next city down the coast.
You may get the formula. Leslie, you talked with a lot of people, Jim Schultz down there in Richmond Crescent, saying, you know, nobody who has a house here is a skeptic. But he also said, this is a science technology writer living in Norfolk, says, as you quote him, the fact is that there is not enough engineering to go around to mitigate the rising sea. Says, for us, he told you, it's the bitter reality of trying to live in a world that's getting warmer and wetter. I mean, is there enough engineering? If you start multiplying this by cities and towns all up and down the East Coast, never mind the rest of the country, Leslie.
Well, there's probably not enough engineering and certainly not enough money for the entire East Coast of the United States. I do think that we will start to make more intelligent decisions and that we will start to allocate money. And places like Norfolk, but also places like New York City, are going to have to decide what can be saved, what could legitimately be saved, and what might be, as Norfolk's also considering, retreat. You can do retreat during a lot of ways. You can do it through zoning, just no more building in those areas.
Mm-hmm.
And then you probably have to find the money to help people pay move to relocate, which is a whole other set of issues.
Just moving out ahead of the incoming sea.
Yeah, and there are places that are doing that. There are places that are zoning, so you can no longer build it. Believe it or not, there are still people, lots of people, who want to build in areas that will be covered by the sea. They want to build there because people want houses by the water. That's still high-priced real estate.
Yeah, they want houses
so
by the water.
So we come to the grips with not building new stuff, much less how we're going to extricate the old stuff.
Everybody wants a house by the water, but not in the water.
I want one of those, too.
Right. Let's get a call. Caller here from Norfolk. In fact, it's Jim. It may be the Jim Schultz that you spoke with. Jim, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Guilty as charged.
Okay.
Yes, it is me. Leslie and I chatted, and we talked about this whole area. Everything that people have been saying this morning, I'm in general and broad agreement with. Most of us here on the front lines get a little shell-shocked as we literally watch the waters rise, as we did last. Right, we had the Veterans Day nor'easter.
Yes, last year.
It was pretty scary to watch the water creep higher and higher. We got about 18 inches of our house, and we were among the lucky ones. We did not get water in the main body of the house. So all of these issues that you've been talking about are what we're confronting daily here in Norfolk. And I think it's terrific. The Navy's being proactive. The city certainly is being proactive. But these are very large problems that affect all of us, and that's not just those of us on the coast. It's people on the interior, too, who may think, hey, we don't have a problem, but there's agriculture, there's aquaculture, there's the tourism industry. All of these things are affected, I think, by this rise in seas.
But, Jim, you must know there, Jim, in Norfolk, not everybody's buying it. I've got a web comment here from Rob in Norfolk. Says, I've lived on or near the Lafayette River in Norfolk for the past 50 years. Although this is a concern to me, he writes, I have yet to see a significant rise in the water level. What do you say to that, Jim?
Well, we experience it day in and day out, and I would invite him, if he wants to swap homes, I'm happy to do so. there are a number of homes around here that have to put up with it. Leslie pointed out the high tides just from the full moon, but those are the nuisance tides. The nor'easters are horrible. They're even worse than the hurricanes, and when you talk about storm surge. And if we get wind from the north or northeast, you can forget about it. We're fortunate, that is to say, where we live, we're kind of the crispy Cheerio up on side of the bowl. So we're less soggy than our neighbors. But these streets are impassable. You know, if the wind is blowing from the northeast at, say, 20 miles an hour, you're going to get 4 or 5 feet of water.
And suddenly, suddenly everybody lives in Venice. Jim Schultz, I appreciate your call very much. You've got other coastal callers coming in here. East Hampton, that's coastal. New York, Francesca. Francesca, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks, Tom, for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Yes, I'm here. I feel like I'm on the front lines of climate change. We also here in New York will at some point experience the same situation, not only because of sea level rise, but we're also more vulnerable. I actually write about these issues, and I've talked to Jim Hansen, the climate scientist, about this, and, you know, personally was concerned, and I asked him, you know, just how high can it go? He's got a study that actually talks about a sea level rise in this century of over 15 feet. So that's about double than what it came out in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago. And I just want to share with your listeners a report that came across my transom just a couple of days ago that's really got me worried. It's from the Royal Society in England, which has published recent data by the Tyndall Climate Change Center and Oxford University that's talking about basically an uninhabitable planet by 2060 unless we begin to cut back our emissions starting 2015. And what they're talking about is basically that we have to stop growing our economies in the advanced nations here if we're going to actually survive. And we're talking us. I mean, I may not live to see it, but I know my son, my children, my grandchild, you know, they're going to have to deal with an uninhabitable situation. So I urge everybody to go to Climate Progress, Joe Rome's blog, where he talks about the recent study.
Francesca, I appreciate your call. Of course, people are going to respond to this in many different ways. And Leslie Coffin with the New York Times, I think you got some pretty fierce pushback to your article from people who were very skeptical about the sort of whole, I don't know, approach.
Yeah, I think there still are a lot of people who are very skeptical about climate change and then very skeptical that there's sea rise. The thing about sea rise is it's measurable. You can argue about what's going to happen next because, of course, it hasn't happened.
Mm-hmm.
But the range of predictions go from very conservative to much more serious, as the last caller pointed out. But there can be no doubt, because we've measured it, that sea rise has occurred over the last century and at an accelerating rate. It's very hard to say at any single point in the land how much has been sea rise and how much has been land sinkage, because it's a very complicated set of variables. But we have pretty good satellite telemetry data now that's letting us know that the sea is rising and at an increased rate. So we get a lot of irate, there's a lot of emotion around this issue because things are changing, they're changing quickly, people are afraid it'll affect their livelihoods. So there's a lot of emotion around the issue, but the fact is sea level is rising.
And places like Norfolk are just having to deal with it and hitch up their boots and put emotion aside a little bit, I guess. We have one of the world's sort of leading authorities on sea levels with us right now. From Durham, North Carolina, Orrin Pilkey is with us, co-author of The Rising Sea, Professor Emeritus of Earth and Ocean Sciences at Duke University. Professor Pilkey, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. I'm pleased to be here.
We're reading about a consensus that there may be a 3-foot sea level rise in this century. You're saying it may be more like 5 feet up by the year 2100. I mean, what would that mean for cities on the East Coast, Professor?
Well, it means a disaster. There's no question about this. It's complex, as we've already been hearing, that we can't possibly respond to the entire East Coast shoreline. And so I think the barrier islands, our 3,500-mile barrier island chain from New York to Mexican border is basically, they're going to be out of it. I think the cities, rightfully so, will trump the funding for responding to sea level rise relative to the barrier islands.
Now, Norfolk is having to deal with this right now, but we're reading here in North Carolina the sea could be a mile inland from where it is now in some areas. How are people on those barrier islands responding to that kind of forecast on your part, Professor Pilkey?
Well, I think for the most part they're not responding. We have been moving some buildings back. For example, we moved 8 buildings back last year on one barrier. No, we demolished them. I'm mm-hmm. sorry. We demolished mm-hmm. the building. But for the most part, I think we still have our head in the sand, from barrier islands. And there are still people, as you say, seeking to buy beachfront property, which is just crazy, you know, just societal madness.
How confident are you in this 3-5, maybe more foot sea rise? I mean, is that speculative? You know, there's an awful lot of skepticism about it.
Yeah, well, there is some skepticism, but I think there are about 8 panels now from different coastal states that have come up with numbers, and almost everybody views 3 feet to be a minimum sea level rise, and the estimates are, I think, are increasing, and I think 5 feet is a better estimate. But yes, there are uncertainties, of course, and unfortunately, the IPCC, the UN agency that puts out these periodic reports, they gave an estimate of 2 feet, and then they didn't mention that it did not include the glaciers. And, of course, the glaciers are the big source of water in the future.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about climate change, rising seas, and one city's battle with the high tide. We're looking at the case of Norfolk, Virginia. Williams Skip Stiles joins us there. He's executive director of Wetlands Watch. In Durham, North Carolina, Orrin Pilkey is with us, professor emeritus of Oath and Urchin Sciences at Duke University, one of the world's leading authorities on what we may be facing here. And from the New York Times, Leslie Kaufman is with us. She's been writing about the Norfolk situation, where they're getting very real. The Navy's getting very real. They got tons of facilities there. And Old Dominion University and more, really on the front lines here. Let's get a call from just across the water there, Newport News, Virginia. Scott, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask your guest about Old Point Comfort, which is a 570-acre spit of land across the water from Norfolk. It's the site of Fort Monroe, which is a deeply historic Army post. Mm-hmm. That's the place where slavery first began to die in the Civil War. Beginning in 1861, thousands of slaves escaped to Fort Monroe, which was a Union stronghold.
Yeah.
In 2011, the post will close and the land will revert to Virginia. Virginia now plans not only to manage the property and preserve its historic assets, but also to allow new development. I wanted to ask your guest about the wisdom of new development at Old Point Comfort, given the threats of sea level rise and flooding.
Well, Scott, I appreciate your call. Skip Stiles, can I come to you on that? What can you tell us?
Yeah, we've looked at that issue. If you wanted another snapshot of sea level rise and decisions being made, that's it. I mean, it's a fort with a barrier island, a couple of feet of sea level rise with a storm surge, and you can't get to it. So from our perspective, it doesn't make much sense to put anything out there that's going to last very long. The best use for that would be a park on open land. If you do a life cycle cost on that decision, you know, what is the cost going to be to maintain those houses out there for the life of a house at 70 to 100 years? It just doesn't pencil out. And then you add to it the potential for risk to the people living out there. I mean, this is a classic case of where our state and federal policies and programs are not aligned with sea level rise. They're all retrospective. You set a 100-year floodplain based on what the flooding has been. And for us, the future is no longer what it once was, you know. I mean, we're not going to get that same level of flooding. So in decisions like, what do you do with this fort that's being given to the state, if you look backwards, it's like, well, we'll just build on it, no problem. But if you look forwards to the reality of sea level rise, you go, no, this has got to be open land.
This must put people with that perspective right up against, though, development interests who want to build there, want to do business, and people who want to live there.
Well, and this is the struggle that we've had. We've been at this for about 4 or 5 years at the local level throughout eastern Virginia, and it gets down to it. The landowner goes, look, I can build by right here, and you're telling me 50 years, maybe the water's coming up, get out of my way. I should be able to build. What's mitigating it is the insurance companies are withdrawing from this part of the state. Allstate, State Farm, Nationwide, USAA, Farmers, Virginia Mutual will either not write new policies or have very restrictive modifications to new policies along the tidal shoreline. Increasingly, Lloyd's of London, you know, the insurer of last resort, is where people are turning for their insurance. And even they aren't writing in some places. You know, Dr. Pilkey's been talking about this for years. And, you know, if we'd listened to him, he wouldn't be in as deep a hole as we are. But, you know, it is becoming very real along the tidal shoreline.
Orrin Pilkey, you've been looking across the pond at Great Britain, where they're in a very get real sort of state of mind these days. And looking at a village there, Norfolk Broads in Great Britain, where the government's just said they won't defend the village against the sea. It's kind of a line in the sand that they've begun to draw, saying, that's it. The government's not going to be backing you up. You're on your own if you stay there.
Yeah, it's very impressive, actually. There are several villages on the Norfolk Broads that they plan to abandon. Now, of course, when the time comes, whether they can do that or not, we'll have to wait and see. But that they're way ahead of the game. But, though I think I would like to say that Norfolk is very exciting what I'm hearing about the plans at Norfolk. Norfolk is way ahead of other communities on the East Coast. And, of course, their problem is worse than other communities.
What are you seeing up and down that coast? Charleston, for example.
Well, Charleston is having a very similar problem. They just change their stormwater drainage system, because it was getting to the point that if they had a heavy rain at high tide, the city wouldn't drain, and they were having flooding in downtown on the peninsula. So they're doing something like Norfolk is doing, and it is these towns. Unfortunately, we seem to be waiting until with the problem arise, but that's okay. We're cities like Norfolk and Charleston really are looking to the future.
What about people are talking about large-scale engineering answers to this, maybe levees and inflatable dams. What about a place like Florida? Will those work in Florida?
Well, Miami is in the most trouble of all. Miami sits atop a very porous limestone, so porous that little ponds inside the city actually reflect the tide. You can see a small tide. So that means if you build a seawall or levee or dike, it won't make the slightest difference. You'll have to build a dam. You'll have to go down to the base of this formation. And so you're basically going to have to build a dam around the entire city to prevent flooding from the sea level rise. So, and unfortunately, Miami is not among the cities that are looking to the future in this issue. And in fact, there's some people on the city council that are denying that sea level rise is occurring, of all places in Miami. It's crazy.
Heads up, Miami. Take a word from Norfolk here. Let's get a call from John. He's on Route 81 northbound in Virginia. John, you're on the air.
Yes, how you doing? I was actually kind of wondering, I've been all over the United States seeing all kinds of natural disasters, and I've actually have been over to Washington State, and what they do over there is they have these floating piers or floating houses on these piers, and they actually go up and down with the tide. I was wondering, is that a viable option that Norfolk possibly could deal with there?
John, thanks for calling. Skip Stiles, what about it? Can you float your waterfront?
Well, there are some who do. They have a pretty high tide range up in Washington. There actually was an interesting exhibit at the Museum of Modern Art in New York where they had some, you know, envision New York with sea level rise, and they had some interesting architectural ideas for living on the water, not next to, but on the water. We're still a ways away from trying to figure out what works here, but some smart people doing some smart design work, landscape architects, engineers. And also, again, borrowing from Europe, because there are some examples of people dealing with this today over there.
Here's a comment online from Dan. He says, I'm a Norfolk, Virginia Beach native, now live in Charleston, South Carolina, where we face the same problem. He writes, this is a no-fix, no-solution situation. You just have to move inland, he writes. Accepting climate change won't change the trend, and recapturing 200 years of CO2 just ain't going to happen on any effective time scale. He says, move back of I-95. Orrin Pilkey, is that alarmist?
No, that's exactly the advice I would give. But, of course, it's viewed as being an alarmist. But we don't have to move back. All of a sudden, we can do a couple things. We can move back gradually, house by house, as they're threatened, and we can learn to live with the barrier island, let them evolve underneath our houses, and I think we can also, plan. We really need to start planning. The response to sea level rise is going to be vastly different in along different parts of our coastal plain. But no, I don't think that's. I don't think that's outrageous at all. I think that's the kind of thinking we actually need.
I've got an email here from Ruby. It's interesting. It's kind of a long one, but it gets to... She says, I'm wondering about the response of people who deny climate change, but also see the need for infrastructure improvements in areas like Norfolk. How do they address the problems, and how do they respond to the idea that more global changes to combat climate change are more likely to be effective in a broader spectrum more permanently than Band-Aid fixes like raising the street level of one street 18 inches for over $1 million? I mean, what about that conversation, Skip? Has Norfolk's sort of battle with the high tide brought the climate change and human role front and center there? Is it bringing people around to... You know, to getting on board as they think about how to battle the tide, or not?
Well, I think we're a little skitsy on this in Virginia. People accept sea level rise. I go out to rural Kiwanis clubs and give talks, and And very conservative people say, yeah, it's changing. You know, when my dad had the house, the water came to the steps. Now it's in the front room. Sea level rise people get, especially after the nor'easter that we had in last year. The broader climate change issue is a difficult one. You know, there are those who are in our state legislature who brag that Virginia is the Saudi Arabia coal. And, you know, our economy is a very carbon-intensive economy, as it is for a lot of states in the Southeast. So, you know, making that bridge from sea level rise to climate change hasn't yet occurred. But, you know, again, to go back to that analogy of the diagnosis from the doctor, you know, we've got the bad x-ray and we're still smoking two packs a day. And, you know, at some point, somebody's got to look around and go, this is not a very smart thing to do.
Barry in Marlborough, Massachusetts. Barry, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm from Australia, and I got a question. Why is it that there are more people who view climate change and this issue of sea level rise with some skepticism here in this country than virtually any other country around the world, especially the European countries? It's viewed very seriously in Australia. I have a house down in Sydney that sits on top of a 35-foot headland, and people are telling me that within 15 to 20 years, that house is going to, in effect, be on an island.
We take the question from down under. Oren Pilkey there, you know, our Australian listener says, what is it about the United States that leads to more skepticism here than elsewhere around the world, even as the water rises?
I think the Australians are way ahead of us. I just came back from a coastal management meeting in Adelaide, Australia. And I was really impressed. And one of the things they're doing, they're making really big setback lines, and they are informing people. They are telling people about the sea level rise. And they even, in one state, they're even telling people, you probably have 30 years or something like that. And I don't understand why the coal and oil companies, I believe, are the primary cause of the skepticism. And they're... Many of them are centered here, of course, and so we're getting a full load of trash talking, in my view. But there is some of that going on in Australia and other countries, but Europe and Australia is just light years ahead of us in recognizing this problem. And if we don't recognize the problem on a broad scale, we're not going to do much about it.
Leslie, what are you seeing around the country in terms of preparation for what's here and what's coming? Is Norfolk way out in front? If you look at, I don't know, Corpus Christi or New Orleans, look at planning going on in other coastal cities, do you see the beginnings of a long-term plan here or not?
I think that the last 2 years have really been, the post-Katrina years have really been actually very powerful in the United States, partly because, as someone early in the conversation explained, insurers pulled back, not so much for flood, which they actually have long ago pawned off to the federal government because of wind damage from Katrina, the understanding that rising sea levels will mean tons more coastal damage. So they're pulling back, which has forced a conversation that a lot of people didn't want to have. And I think you are beginning to see, especially in East Coast cities, New York and Boston, a little bit farther along than other people because they have to plan for 30 years out, questions about what should we be doing now to deal with this serious problem. And I feel like you haven't seen a lot of movement, but you have seen the conversation awake in the last couple of years, at least in a few places.
Do you see anything going on in Cancun this week where the UN annual conference is going on? It was kind of a big bust in Copenhagen last year, but do you see anything going on this week that begins to get the sort of global arms around the scale of this challenge, Leslie?
I'm not seeing a lot of global movement at the global level that's very encouraging. I mean, Cancun's goals even are immensely modest. So I'm beginning to think that maybe we're going to have to, everyone's going to have to start dealing a lot more with adaptation because we don't seem to be, as a globe, able to get our arms around mitigation.
Oren Pilkey, here's a web comment from Richard, says, until concrete things start to happening, like a city in Virginia being underwater, Americans consider this one more abstract concept. How quickly do you think this is going to become concrete for people, you know, around the country, along the coast, maybe first of all, Dr. Pilkey?
Well, I think with articles from people like Leslie and more articles along that line, we can start making people believers, make believers out of the skeptics, because there is so much evidence, especially when you throw in the agricultural impacts, the fishing impacts, the fact that I have a friend who fishes on a river in North Carolina, and he has to go 10 miles up the river now to catch freshwater fish from where he used to go because of sea level rise, and so forth and so on. If we really, well, we try to do this in our book to some extent, but if we really started publicizing, like Leslie has been doing, I think we can make believers out of people, because it's here. It's with us right now.
Skip Stiles, do you feel that sort of consensus to get ready, get busy, get out, try and get out in front of this coalescing in Norfolk now?
It's in Norfolk and all throughout eastern Virginia. As I say, you know, you go from Lewisette up on the Potomac all the way around to Tangier Island. I think after the storms that we've had in the last couple of years, and as Leslie said, it really has been the last couple of years that people, that sort of post-Katrina slap to the forehead going, my gosh, there's something going on here. It's not just random, and it's moving in one direction, and I don't like it. The next steps are for the state and federal governments to start going, okay, here's some help for you. And right now, as I said, a lot of federal policies are misaligned. They're retrospective. They look backwards. They don't provide guidance to local governments. I mean, local governments is where this is all happening. The little cities on the water are going, okay, what do I do?
But we've got a Congress coming in, a Republican majority, a lot of skeptics about man-made climate change.
Well, talk to the insurance companies. Tell me if you can do business along the shoreline.
That may be the line in the sand, sadly. Skip Stiles, joining us today from Norfolk, Virginia, Executive Director of Wetlands Watch there. Thank you so much for your time and insights today, Skip.
Thank you for having me on.
And Orrin Pilkey, Dr. Orrin Pilkey, Professor Emeritus of Earth and Ocean Sciences at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina, with us today, co-author of The Rising Sea. Orrin Pilkey, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, for sure.
Leslie Kaufman, thanks for your reporting, and thank you for being here today from the New York Times. Thanks, Leslie.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for all your calls and insights. You can continue the conversation at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.